Knowledge Products presents Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Part 3.
Marx's definition of value in terms of labor has been much criticized, though it has also been much misrepresented. Two critics of Marx who took the trouble to study him thoroughly and understand exactly what he was driving at were Wicksteed and Böhm Verwerk, both of them great economists. In 1884, the year after Marx's death, the Reverend Philip Henry Wicksteed, who was an economist, a Unitarian minister, and an active socialist, published a criticism of Marx in a socialist journal. George Bernard Shaw, then a Marxist, replied to Wicksteed, but Wicksteed eventually convinced Shaw that Marx's labor theory was incorrect and that the new marginal utility theory was correct. This played a part in assuring that English socialism never became Marxist. Wicksteed points out that Marx had said that, to produce value, labor must be useful labor. Therefore, it is not true that the only thing in common between two goods exchanged for each other is labor. They also have usefulness, the capacity to satisfy wants.
If only useful labor counts, then when the wares are reduced to mere indifferent products of such labor, in the abstract, they are still useful in the abstract. And therefore it is not true that nothing remains to them but the one attribute of being products of labor. For the attribute of being useful also remains to them.
As Wicksteed goes on to point out, usefulness or utility has the advantage over labor, because utility applies also to exchangeable goods which have not taken labor to produce, such as land. All exchange goods must have utility. Someone must want them. But not all exchange goods are products of labor. Another criticism of Marx's theory of value is that his treatment of skilled labor as a multiple of simple average labor is a circular argument. We know that some kinds of labor are more productive than others because this is reflected in market prices. But we cannot rely on market prices to explain market prices. As the Austrian economist Eugene von Böhm-Verwerk puts it,
it simply means that Marx is arguing in a complete circle. The real subject of inquiry is the exchange relations of commodities. Why a statuette, which has cost a sculptor one day's labor, should exchange for a cart of stones, which has cost a stonebreaker 5 days' labor, and not for a larger or smaller quantity of stones. How does Marx explain this? He says the exchange relation is this and no other because one day of sculptor's work is reducible exactly to 5 days of unskilled work. And why is it reducible to exactly 5 days? Because experience shows that it is so reduced by a social process. And what is this social process? The same process that has to be explained, that very process by means of which the product of one day of sculptor's labor has been made equal to the value of the product of 5 days of common labor. It is clear that we shall never learn in this way the actual reasons why products of different kinds of work should be exchanged in this or that proportion.
Another problem with Marx's theory is that it does not apply well to what is called joint production. For example, if a cow is slaughtered, the different parts of the cow will sell at different prices. These prices cannot be explained by labor, since the cow was produced in one piece. No more labor went into the loins than into the shins, but sirloin costs more per pound than shin. Marx claims to show that interest on capital is gained by exploitation, by the legalized robbery of the workers. Marx constantly refers to rent, interest, and profit, which he together calls surplus value, as having been robbed, stolen, filched, or swindled from the workers by their capitalist employers. Marx poses a riddle and claims to have solved it. If commodities exchange equal value for equal value, how is interest on capital to be explained? Some writers before Marx had claimed that interest was due to the swindling or exploitation of the workers. These writers, such as the English socialist John Bray, contended that workers were underpaid, that they received less than their rightful due. The same idea occurs in the writings of the French socialist anarchist Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who proposed that interest be eliminated by making prices conform to labor values. Marx's approach is different. He wants to show that interest can be extracted by exploiting the workers without any goods or services exchanging above or below their values as determined by labor time. Marx believes that if all commodities exchange exactly at their values, exploitation will still occur. Marx's puzzle is this. A man has a sum of money. He uses it to buy labor, equipment, and other resources. He then sells the products of these resources, and lo and behold, he receives a larger sum of money than he started with. How is this possible without any commodity being bought or sold above or below its value?
Our friend Moneybags, who as yet is only an embryo capitalist, must buy his commodities at their value, must sell them at their value, and yet, at the end of the process, must withdraw more value from circulation than he threw into circulation at the beginning.
Marx's solution is as follows. He distinguishes between labor and labor power. Only labor creates value, but the worker is not paid for his labor. He is paid for his labor power, which is less. Labor power is the capacity to work or to labor. Wages, says Marx, are not the price of labor, but the price of labor power. The value of labor power is determined, according to Marx, in the same way as the value of any other commodity, by the labor time necessary to produce it. This means that wages are determined by what it costs in labor time to produce the worker's capacity to labor, or in other words, what it costs to produce the worker himself. But what it costs to produce the worker means the same as what it costs to produce the worker's necessary items of consumption. Wages, then, do not pay the worker for his work, but for his keep. They cover his subsistence. But a worker can produce more than his subsistence, and this is the source of interest or profit.
The fact that half a day's labor is necessary to keep the laborer alive does not in any way prevent him from working a whole day. During one part of the labor process, the laborer produces only the value of his labor power, that is, the value of his means of subsistence. During the second period of the labor process, the worker expends labor power, but since his labor is no longer necessary labor, he creates no value for himself. He creates surplus value, which, for the capitalist, has all the charms of a creation out of nothing.
So wages are fixed by the labor cost of producing food, clothing, shelter, and a few other amenities. But a worker can produce more than it costs to pay for these subsistence goods, and it is this extra that goes to the capitalist as surplus value or profit. Suppose that a worker works 12 hours a day. According to Marx, part of that work, say half of it or 6 hours, goes to replace the worker's wage. The rest of it goes to the capitalist employer as profit. Marx mentions three economic systems in which exploitation takes place. Under slavery, where the slave is owned outright by the slave owner still has to feed the slave. Therefore, the slave works part of the time to replace the value of his own subsistence. The rest goes to the slave owner. Similarly, under feudalism, the peasant or serf works part of the time producing food for himself, the rest of the time producing for the lord. Marx says that capitalism is, like slavery and like feudalism, a system of exploitation. But the exploitation is disguised. In all three systems, the worker spends part of the time producing his or her own subsistence, and the rest of the time producing a surplus for the owners. In Marx's view, these systems are substantially the same, and capitalist exploitation is only disguised by the voluntary contract between worker and employer. For the worker has no choice. He has to find an employer or die. Superficially, it seems as if the worker is paid for all the time he works. But in reality, he is paid for only part of the time.
Under a feudal system of compulsory labor, the labor of the worker for himself and his compulsory labor for his lord differ in space and time in the clearest possible way. In slave labor, even that part of the working day in which the slave is only replacing the value of his own means of existence, in which, therefore, he works for himself alone, appears as labor for his master. All the slave's labor appears as unpaid labor. In wage labor, on the contrary, even surplus labor or unpaid labor appears as paid. Under slavery, the property relation conceals the labor of the slave for himself. Under capitalism, the money relation conceals the unrequited labor of the wage laborer. The Roman slave was held by fetters. The wage laborer is bound to his owner by invisible threads. The appearance of independence is kept up by means of a constant change of employers and by the juridical fiction of a contract.
But is it true that only the worker's labor counts in producing value? Surely if a worker uses machines to make shirts, the machines contribute something to the shirts? Marx's reply to this is to deny that a machine can create any new value. A machine eventually wears out. While it is in use, it is, says Marx, passing on its value to the final product. Thus, the value of the shirt includes the value of machines and other equipment used up in making the shirt. So the value of a shirt includes not only the labor, which finally went into making the shirt, but a part of the labor that went into making the stitching machine, the cloth, and even the tools used to plant and harvest the original cotton plant. But once produced, capital equipment can create no more value. Its existing value is frozen. Furthermore, says Marx, the labor used to make the equipment came from exploited workers in the past. So even the equipment does not rightfully belong to the capitalist. Marx's conclusion is that profit, or surplus value, is entirely derived from unpaid labor. To Marx, a capitalist is primarily someone who receives income just from owning wealth, which is used to make profits by employing wage workers. The pure capitalist is a coupon clipper, or rentier. A manager, in Marx's view, is a wage laborer, not a capitalist.
Just as, at first, the capitalist is relieved from actual labor so soon as his capital has reached that minimum amount with which capitalist production as such begins, so now he hands over the work of direct and constant supervision of the individual workman to a special kind of wage laborer. An industrial army of workmen under the command of a capitalist requires, like a real army, officers or managers and sergeants, foremen or overseers who command in the name of the capitalist.
In Marx's theory, a worker with an interest-bearing savings account is a little bit of a capitalist, since the interest comes ultimately from exploiting workers. A capitalist is acting partly as a worker if he works in his own factory. But Marx believes that these mixed forms are disappearing or becoming less important. Capitalists are handing over their administrative tasks to paid managers. Thus, capitalists are becoming superfluous or redundant, and it is difficult to justify their continued existence. As evidence that capitalists no longer play a vital role in production, Marx points to the labor-managed firms or producers' cooperatives being tried out by some enthusiasts in 19th-century England.
The capitalist mode of production has brought matters to a point where the work of supervision, entirely divorced from the ownership of capital, is always readily obtainable. It has therefore
come to be useless for the capitalist to perform it himself. An orchestra conductor need not own the instruments of his orchestra, nor is it within the scope of his duties as conductor to have anything to do with the wages of the other musicians. Cooperative factories furnish proof that the capitalist has become no less redundant as a functionary in production, as he himself, looking down from his high perch, finds the big landowner redundant. The wages of management, both for the commercial and industrial manager, are completely isolated from the profits of enterprise in the cooperative factories of laborers, as well as in capitalist stock companies. The separation of wages of management from profits of enterprise, purely accidental at other times, is here constant.
Marx recognized that when a capitalist works as a manager in his own factory, part of his so-called profit is really payment for his labor power. What accountants mean when they talk about profits is usually made up of three separate components: pure profit due to unusual foresight, wages of management, and the regular rate of return on capital. The regular rate of return on capital is sometimes called interest or normal profit. Marx understands this threefold composition of business profits, and when he writes about the rate of profit, the fruits of exploiting the laborers, he is concerned only with interest, or the normal rate of profit. Marx claims that the worker receives in wages only his subsistence, but Marx does not interpret subsistence in a minimum biological sense.
If the owner of labor power works today, tomorrow he must again be able to repeat the same process in the same conditions as regards health and strength. His means of subsistence must therefore be sufficient to maintain him in his normal state as a laboring individual. The number and extent of his so-called necessary wants and the ways of satisfying them are the product of historical development, and therefore depend to a great extent on the degree of civilization of a country, more particularly on the conditions under which the class of free laborers have been formed, and consequently on their habits and degree of comfort. Unlike other commodities, there enters into the determination of the value of labor power a historical and moral element.
Marx's position means that no matter how high wages may go, and no matter how many luxuries the workers may be able to afford, wages can still be described as subsistence wages. Long before Marx, economists had believed that wages tended toward subsistence, with subsistence being culturally rather than biologically defined. The reasoning behind this belief was that if wages rose, workers would have more children, and the increased supply of laborers would then bid wages down again. On the other hand, if wages fell, workers would have fewer children, mainly by postponing their marriages. The workers would delay marriage until the point where they expected to be able to support a family in the customary style. Thus, the wages of workers would tend toward the minimum that workers felt was tolerable. The classical economists therefore believed that a brief improvement in workers' wages would have no permanent effects, because the workers would quickly have more children, who would appear on the labor market after a few years and bid down wages. But if, by some fortunate series of events, wages could be raised for a lengthy period of time, the workers would get used to this higher standard of comfort, and if they insisted upon that standard when they came to make decisions about marriage, this might lead to a permanent improvement. Marx takes over this classical theory of culturally defined subsistence, but strangely enough, he throws out the population theory which accounts for it. Instead, Marx sees the level of wages being fixed chiefly by what he calls the class struggle, competition between workers and capitalists, which might take the form of strikes or of legislative interference. but this means that it is difficult to see what makes wages tend toward subsistence, however subsistence might be defined. Marx gives no explanation for why the struggle between workers and capitalists should lead to a subsistence wage. It seems that whatever wage level emerges, Marx will call it subsistence. But in that case, the claim that wages are fixed by subsistence is hollow. Marx and his followers believe that his theory of surplus value, his explanation of how and why workers are exploited by capitalists, is his greatest achievement. Marx believes he has unearthed a terrible scandal about capitalism, which other economists are forever trying to cover up. Yet the theory is something of a puzzle. You might think that since the workers are not paid for the whole value of what they produce, Marx is proposing that they should get this full value. But Marx scoffed at this as so much utopian nonsense. He is quite clear that in a communist society, a large part of what the workers produce will have to be withheld from them for reinvestment, insurance, administrative expenses, and other purposes. Another guess at what Marx is getting at might be that he objects to the capitalist's personal consumption on yachts, mansions, and racehorses. But it is quite clear from reading Marx that he holds this personal consumption to be a minor aspect of exploitation. Some commentators on Marx have tried to explain this puzzle by saying that Marx wanted to expose the contradictions and hypocrisy of the established bourgeois way of thinking. Capitalism claims that every person receives the full value of his labor, and Marx is trying to refute this. The problem with Marx's interpretation is that defenders of capitalism in the 19th century did not argue like that at all. Hardly anyone has ever held that people should receive the value of their labor and only the value of their labor. The best explanation for Marx's attitude seems to be that he thinks of the capitalists as alien and hostile to the workers. Therefore, when the capitalists, just by owning property, extract surplus value by paying workers less than their product, this amounts to exploitation. But when the communist administration keeps back part of the workers' product, this is done by agreement of all the workers themselves. It is merely part of the product going to the workers collectively instead of to the workers individually. A difficulty with Marx's theory of exploitation is that he tries to arrive at ethical or moral conclusions without revealing his ethical theory. We can say that someone is robbed or exploited only if we are able to apply principles which identify who rightfully owns what. Without a theory of rightful ownership, a theory of exploitation is meaningless. But Marx is reticent about the principles underlying his moral judgments.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.